Okay. Thank you. Good evening. Topic number two in our series, a series of four. Note that next week we do not meet. Next week is a skip week because I expect to be in Israel that week. But then we have two more weeks following, so February 7th and February 14th, God willing. Topic tonight is censorship of Jewish texts. And really, there are two different aspects to the censorship of Jewish texts. There's censorship that Jews did of their own texts, and then there's censorship done to us from the outside. What we're going to focus on is censorship from the outside, which Jews also ended up doing. Because, well, we'll see. But what I'm not going to focus on, although it's a fascinating topic, is censorship from within. In other words, the Jewish community itself deciding that certain things should not be published, should not be read, and so on. The censorship that came from the outside begins almost with the beginning of Christianity. I mean, Paul ordered the burning of heretical books, but it wasn't targeted at Jews. It wasn't about Jews. It wasn't about Torah. It was about heresy. So that the first formal restrictions actually occur with someone who I hope I don't mispronounce. Last week I spent the entire time saying Padua when it was Padua. Yeah, so let's go for it this time and see what I can do with the English language today. Or that was Italian. A fellow by the name of Arius lost a theological debate on the stance of the Father and Son in the Trinity. This was in 325 in the Council of Nicaea. And he wrote a poem called Thalia, T-H-A-L-I-A, defending his position. I don't have the flu, but people can sit to my left or to my right, that's fine. So the church actually banned his poem, because they felt that it was heretical. And the rules of the Council of Nicaea were that they would burn the book if the book was considered heretical, and they would prescribe capital punishment for the reader. So that was fairly effective as censorship goes. A century later, in the year 435, there was a church leader by the name of Nestorius, and he lost a debate on the nature of Mary and how one could be both divine and man, and his views were considered to be, again, heretical. So Theodosius III ordered the burning of all of his writings and capital punishment for the reader, since I guess it had worked so well a century earlier. The first catalog, the reader, yes, which is far more effective, I think, on the whole. The first catalog of restricted books appears under Pope Gelasius I in the year 496. There was a council that actually put it out. And again, it was for heretical works. It had nothing to do with Jews and Judaism. It was just generally anti-church writings. However, this catalog that he produces, which will become known as an index, isn't really enforced. Not until you get to the early 13th century. You have a serious gap of years, obviously, in between. Largely because this was a period, and particularly as you move along from the 5th century you get later, it's a period we call the Dark Ages. And during the Dark Ages, there is a general indifference to book learning. So books aren't seen as a threat. The fact that somebody somewhere wrote something that said, you know, that argued for a different belief system from my own really didn't matter a whole lot. So there was nothing done. Also, they didn't have enforcement mechanisms in place, which we'll talk about in a little bit. There were instances of book burnings, but they tended to be more for the sake of destruction than censorship. In the 11th century, the Crusaders burned books as they marched through Europe, but it wasn't because they cared about the contents; it was because they were destroying property in general, and you know, books were property. The revival of censorship comes into play in the 12th century, the late 12th century, through a man by the name of Peter the Venerable. He was the abbot of the Benedictine order in Cluny, and he conducted an examination of the Talmud for the purpose of ridiculing the Talmud. Now, you know, there are other sources of comedy out there in the greater world, but his purpose was not to get a laugh out of the Talmud. His purpose was to convince Jews to convert. And the idea was, if you would show Jews how irrational their teachings were, then they would come to accept the light of Christianity. He argued that Jewish teachings make God seem foolish, and that's what's keeping Jews from accepting Christianity overall. And that was the beginning of a new wave of censorship. Censorship restarts at that period, basically.
Excuse me, yes. But he didn't actually burn any books.
Correct. His examination leads to.
But he himself just made fun of them.
I believe that's correct. I don't think he actually was involved in the banning of books. But it presages really what comes next, which is the restart of censorship in the end of the 12th century, beginning of the 13th century. And it comes about for several reasons. One, the end of the Dark Ages. You have a revival of European learning, and then suddenly books matter again. And that's number one. Number two, the church develops an approach, which Peter already had started on, of rational debate. Rational doesn't mean kind and nice and gentle. It just means rational debate, logical debate. So what they would do is they would hold forced debates where, you know, you had to debate with them, and one of two things would happen. Either you lost the debate in the eyes of the impartial judges, of course, in which case you had to convert, or you won the debate, in which case they expelled you. You know, those were your options. You know, heads I win, tails you lose. You're familiar with the concept.
Yeah.
So that's the that system emphasizes book learning and intellect. They held forced sermons, right? Forced sermons today means that they close the doors of the sanctuary and say, well, these doors will not be open until a sermon is over. But forced sermon in those days meant that Jews were compelled on Sunday to go to church to hear the preacher speak on whatever topic there was, and the point was the moral education of these Jews, that they would come to see the light. So that's part of the general approach. And again, Jewish texts are seen as either dangerous, or, if not dangerous, holding Jews back from seeing the light. So another reason to get these books out of the way, so that they'll quit interfering. So that's another reason why censorship restarts. A third reason why censorship restarted was the creation of enforcers. The orders of the Dominicans as well as the Franciscans were created in order to carry out orders by, instructions by the Pope. In the year 1207, Pope Innocent authorized the legates of the Pope, the papal legates, to license preachers who would travel from place to place. One of them was a man by the name of Domingo de Guzman, also known as Dominic. And he attracted other monks to his cause, and they became the Dominicans. This was in the year 1214 that they were formally the licensed, so to speak, as the order of the Dominicans. By 1221, they had 60 convents in 8 provinces around Europe. Spain, France, England, Germany, Hungary, Lombardy, Romagnola, Provence. In the same period, Giovanni Bernardone Francesco founds the order of the Franciscans, and they carry out the Pope's orders. So where until now the Pope would issue a decree, and there was no one really to carry it out unless the secular courts decided that they wanted to go along with it, which is a discussion we'll come back to. But now he suddenly had his own police squad, effectively. And then the fourth reason, and the final reason, why censorship could restart is that this is also the period of the birth of the Inquisition. The Inquisition meaning that the church could come to a place, set up shop, and start investigating people for crimes, and then ultimately trying and punishing them for those crimes. So in the beginning, they worked through secular courts, but that didn't work, because the secular courts had other things to worry about. They were pretty neglectful of the church concerns. Then they tried through special messengers and legates called the papal nuncio, but those were also inefficient. They tried to exert pressure on state government to try to get the government to enforce it, and the government generally didn't want to because it was very bad for business for you to go out against heretics and particularly Jews, for reasons that we'll also come back to. But ultimately, with the Dominicans and the Franciscans, Gregory the Ninth found that the papal inquisition could really take hold, and in 1227, that's when he began it, this version of the Inquisition. So we have four reasons why censorship starts in earnest at the end of the 12th century, beginning of the 13th century. One, the revival of European learning in general. Two, the church's approach to rational debate. Third, the creation of the Dominican and Franciscan orders. And then fourth, the creation of the Inquisition. All of this comes together to make censorship suddenly a reality, and in particular against Jews, as we will see, because there were forces beyond these that made it easy for the church to take on Jewish writing. Well, there's a lot we can say on this, but I'm gonna go forward and I may come back to this, actually. There's more to say. But what I want to do is go through, as you see on your sheet, the chronology, and then come back to the mechanics of censorship, the role that Jews themselves played, and the lasting impact of the censorship on Jewish practice and belief through the ages. So the first period is the 13th century. Major case, probably best known case in the 13th century, I made reference to it last week also, was the burning of the Talmud in Paris in 1240. And the way that began was with a Jew, and we will find that many of these cases begin with Jews. There's a man by the name of Nicholas Donnan. Donnan was a Jew who had converted to Christianity. He was not born Nicholas. I don't know his birth name. And he went to Pope Gregory the Ninth and presented him with 35 points against the Talmud. 35 charges against the Talmud. Not because Gregory had solicited this, but because Nicholas was bored one Sunday and, you know, needed something to do. He charged that the Talmud distorted biblical text in order to come out with its interpretations and statements about God in particular. He said that Judaism teaches unworthy conceptions of God, that Jews value the words of the rabbis more than the words of biblical text and revelation at Sinai, that there's abusive language regarding Christianity, and so on and so on. So Gregory instructs the secular as well as religious rulers of France, France, England, Castile, Aragon, and Portugal to confiscate all copies of the Talmud and give them to the Franciscans and Dominicans to be examined. And this declaration is made on the first Saturday of Lent. You know, some people give up, fatty foods for Lent. Well, some people give up the Talmud for Lent. So Jews were expected to do that. Spain and England ignored it, but France did not. In France, there was a penalty of death for a Jew who would not cooperate. Now, the judges did not actually know Hebrew. And so in some cases, the rabbis who were summoned for not complying refuted the charges against them. But ultimately, you're working against the Pope. And you know, the principal rule in this is that the house always wins. And that was what would happen for Jews as well. Sometimes in some localities, they managed to pay off the government to say, look, spare us this decree. They got a little bit of a delay. But ultimately, it came down to a debate between Nicholas and four rabbis. Rather well-known ones, including one, Rabbi Yechiel of Paris, who was a particularly great authority of the time. This was held on June 24th, the year 1240. And the rabbis were expected to convince the papal commission that the Talmud was not all these things that Donnan said it was, which they couldn't do. Donnan wasn't fabricating things from scratch. He was taking actual text and distorting it, taking it out of context, taking statements and using them to his own ends, taking that which was allegory or anthropomorphism about God and saying, no, this is meant literally. The church said, absolutely, you know, this could mislead people. It's what's keeping Jews from converting. They're very frustrated with these, you know, Jews who won't convert. And so in the end, there's a public burning of wagon loads of Jewish books. Now remember, this is pre-printing press. So the effect is devastating. We'll talk a little bit more about this at the end. But the effect on learning is incredible. It just decimates the study of Torah in France, where really that had been a major center. Remember that in the 10th century, you find the demise of the schools in Babylon and in northern Africa. You find the growth of schools in Italy. That moves from Italy to Germany. There's a big family known as the Clonimus family that moves from Italy to Germany and sets up shop there. There was a rabbi there, Rabbeinu Gershom, who was a particularly powerful authority. And then Rashi, in the 11th century, basically, sets up shop in France, in Troyes. He studies in Germany, but then he comes back to France, and he sets up shop there. And that becomes the major center of Torah study. But with the burning of the Talmud, it really destroys what Rashi and his descendants had built up. And the center after that shifts to Spain. So that's a particularly grave case that occurs in the 13th century. Another very interesting case. Anyone ever see the movie The Disputation? It's a fictionalization, but it's a fun one. It stars actor Christopher Lee, interestingly. He plays James of Aragon. And it's about the disputation is about, this debate between Nachmanides, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, a principal legal authority, Talmudic scholar, mystic as well, and biblical commentator of Spain in the middle of the 13th century, against Pablo Cristiani, a Jew who had converted out. Cristiani also was not his given name, like Nicholas Donnan. What happens is, in the year 1263, the Dominicans pressed King James to burn the Talmud on the strength of this fellow Pablo Cristiani. And James does not want to do it. Based on historical accounts, it seems that James considered this to be barbaric and did not want to comply. He had his own issues with the church. And so he doesn't want to do it. He's pressured. There's a debate between Nachmanides and Pablo Cristiani. We actually have a surviving text of the debate given to us by Nachmanides himself. And I believe there are other versions of it that are around as well. And of course, you always have to look at the text and wonder, well, who wrote down what really happened? But it's a great text, and they actually bring pieces of it in that film, The Disputation. It's not entirely from it. Of course, it's a film. But nonetheless, in the end, Nachmanides actually wins. Well, Pablo is not happy, especially because James doesn't exile Nachmanides, the usual punishment for winning. So Pablo goes to Pope Clement IV and complains about Nachmanides as well as James. So on August 19th, 1263, the Pope orders through James that Jews must now submit their work for expurgation rather than burning. We're going to come back to expurgation a little bit later, but expurgation means that instead of burning the book, you actually modify it to get rid of that which is offensive. Blotting things out with ink, that tearing out pages, that sort of thing.
How do you spell that?
With great difficulty. No. E-X-P-U-R-G-A-T-I-O-N.
Thank you.
Sure.
Question.
Yes.
Do you have any examples of, like, going back to when Donin or Christiani, when they came forward to make a case against the Talmud? Any specific examples?
Sure. To take Christiani, who we just mentioned in 1263, one of his chief arguments was that when you look in the Talmud, you can find sources for Christian ideas, and therefore Jews should really be adopting Christianity. So, for example, there's a passage in the Talmud that says that on the 9th of Av, which is the day that we usually mark as the day that the temple was destroyed, the Messiah was born. So Pablo says, well, you know, the temple is destroyed somewhere at the beginning of the Common Era. By his day, it's already 1,200 years earlier. We generally say it's the year 68 or the year 70. But Pablo says, you know, that could be a reference to our Savior. Then the Talmud is actually predicting that. And then Nachmanides says, no, this isn't, the point wasn't to say historically our Savior was born that day. The point is that our salvation has its roots even in our destruction. That sort of a message. That's one of them that comes up. Another is that the Talmud talks about divine wrath and God being angry at one moment during the day, or God laughing at various times. And the Christians consider this an unworthy conception of God. It went against their ideas about God. There are passages in the Talmud that seem to relate to Jesus. They seem to be about him. You can't ever know for sure. The chronology, it doesn't quite match, generally speaking, but it sounds like it. There's a story about a man by the name of Yehoshua ben Prachya, who was a Talmudic sage, who had a student who was identified as Yeshu Hanotzri. That's the term used. Yeshu, Yud Shin Vav, sounds an awful lot like J-E-S-U-S. You can see the link. Hanotzri is of Nazareth. And the description is that he has a student, this student, Yeshu Hanotzri, who goes off and starts practicing sorcery and whatever, and then he tries to come back one day, and Yehoshua ben Prachya is reciting the Shema, and you're not supposed to interrupt when you're reciting the Shema, so he holds up his hand, as in wait, but the student takes that as a sign of go away, and so he goes away and becomes corrupt. And the message is that you're not supposed to send people away. You're supposed to always be open to them, because look at what happened as a result of him sending him away. You get the idea. So they read these stories and didn't particularly like them, because accusations that their Savior dabbled in sorcery and all that, it don't go over well.
They just spun the book, really, didn't they?
So the church looks at things like this and says, well, this is offensive to us. We must eliminate it. That sort of thing.
How do you decide who wins a disputation? They can both, I suppose. I mean, who determine that Nefarim is one?
Right, so you actually have a council of judges.
Oh, you do? Oh, okay. Yes. Oh, and I actually said that?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. The Nachmanides wins the debate, apparently. But, yeah, so the result is expurgation. The books don't get burned, but the Jews don't cooperate. They don't turn over their books. And so there are new decrees in 1264 and 1265. James, though, keeps repealing the decrees as they are issued. Finally, in the year 1266, the Pope says, here's the deal, James. Either you comply or I excommunicate you. And at that point, it seems like he does indeed carry it out and confiscate the books. This doesn't keep Jews from publishing, interestingly, and this is, again, pre-printing press. But this period, the 13th century, sees an explosion of Jewish publication. Tremendous writing. Biblical commentary, Talmudic study, responsa, mysticism. This is the period when the Zohar is first published. This is the period when major biblical commentaries are published. Major works of philosophy come to light. They're not stopping. Despite the fact that the church is working as fast as it can to eliminate these texts. Yes?
Just quick, when we say this is the period, what?
13th century still.
So about 100 years?
Yes. Yeah, no, pretty much 100 year period. It starts really the end of the 12th and it continues pretty much through the 13th. The second period begins with the beginning of the 14th century and it continues into most of the 15th, almost 200 years. And that's a lull. Censorship fails at that point. The decrees don't work, in part because communities needed Jews. I alluded to this before. Remember that in the aftermath of the Crusades, Christians and Muslims are not speaking to each other. They're not doing business with each other. They're not trading, and they're not lending money. Keep in mind as well that under church law, Christians are not allowed to lend to other Christians unless they're going to do it as an interest-free loan, right?
And Jews do.
Right. They have the same principle. They got it's not a mystery where they got it, but Christians cannot lend to other Christians with interest, and Muslims cannot lend to other Muslims with interest. But the problem is that in general, lending money without charging interest is not a very good idea economically. It's charity is what it is. Charity, philanthropy, zakat, whatever religious term you want to put on it, tzedakah for us. And while it's a very nice thing to do, it generally doesn't proliferate. You don't find a lot of loans like interest-free loans around. And so people with businesses, farmers, are not able to invest in their farms. Tradesmen are not able to invest in the tools they need. Merchants are not able to invest in their merchandise. So everyone's pretty much stuck. And the way that they, think of the crash the last few years around the world, when there's no credit, when no one will extend the loan, businesses fail. So the ones who are the solution to this are the Jews. Because the Christians can't get loans from other Christians. They can't get loans from Muslims, but Jews can lend them the money. And ditto the other way for the Muslims. So the Jews end up becoming money lenders. It is true that another incentive for becoming money lenders was the fact that Jews were limited in the trades they could enter, but the main reason is because they're the only ones who can lend money. That's realistically, within the populations, it's the only way it's going to work. So the result is that countries need Jews. And they don't want to be in a position of causing the Jews discomfort or the Jews will leave. In fact, we find the major growth of Turkey and Poland after the expulsion of Jews from Spain and Portugal, because that's where Jews went. Math. The Jews did very well in the Italian provinces in particular, interestingly. And that's, we talked about last week, with the golden age of Jewish literature there and the use of the printing press. So that lasts until pretty much the late 15th century. That brings us to the third period. And the third period really takes us to modern times. And this is when the church became very afraid of printing presses. So that between the 1470s and 1490s, the church tried to declare control of publication and the extent of the Inquisition to cover it. Last week we talked about the role of the Venetian Senate in Venice, but the church is trying to control what you may print and what you may not print. We saw the ban, we mentioned it at the end last week, on Jewish-run printing in Italian provinces. Right, that we learned about. In the 1550s, there was a move by the Dominicans to burn the Talmud and other Jewish books in the Italian provinces. In the year 1595, the Bishop of Mantua, which I'm probably mispronouncing, it could be Mantua or Mantua. What do you think? Vote?
Mantua.
Okay. Established a three-person commission to review all books that were in existence. Pretty good, huh? And to censor them. So that Jews living in Mantua were required to bring their books for censorship. It took 3 years. And then after that, they moved on to other cities and tried to implement this there. It didn't always work, though. There was a lot of tension between the church and the European trend toward liberalism that was just beginning to grow at that stage. And there's a fascinating showdown between a man named Joseph Johann Pfefferkorn, who was a Dominican, and another former Jew. That brings us to three, I think, so far in this session. It was a showdown between him and a Christian gentleman by the name of Johann Reuchlin. I have both names there on the sheet, I believe. Yeah, they're both there. Pfefferkorn published a work called Das Judenspiegel, which was meant to be a source for attacks on the Talmud. And there was a German king by the name of Maximilian who authorized Pfefferkorn in the year 1509 to examine all Jewish-owned books and destroy anything that was against the Bible or against Christianity. Jews protested, and liberal Christians protested as well. The Archbishop of, I'm going to mispronounce this one, Gemingen, declared the decree illegal. Too broad, too harsh, go back to the drawing board. So Pfefferkorn says, yeah.
Sorry, it's a side question, not directly related.
Okay.
What precipitated this Christian liberalism?
My sense is that it's with the spread of knowledge in general. And it's a larger question, really, about what leads to the Renaissance and all of that. But my sense is that it's with the spread of book learning and knowledge and a greater growth of cosmopolitanism, if you will.
Okay.
The hard enough word. But I believe that that's what we generally attribute it to. Sure. So Pfefferkorn goes back to the church and says, I'd like an assistant to work with me to actually do the research to show that indeed these books are dangerous. So he is assigned Johann Reuchlin, a young priest, who had actually learned Hebrew from Rabbi Ovadia Sforno. Rabbi Ovadia Sforno is the author of a classic biblical commentary, was certainly an accomplished linguist, and that relationship became very, very helpful for us because Reuchlin decides that Pfefferkorn's charges are false. He says, no, these books aren't dangerous. The Jews are not heretical. He would make no mistake about it. He's a priest. He wasn't supporting Judaism. But at the same time, he opposes Pfefferkorn. So there's a showdown. And Pfefferkorn goes to King Maximilian's sister, who was a countess, and he gets another decree, again, for the destruction of Jewish books. This is in July of 1510. Reuchlin rouses support on his side from the university at Heidelberg, and again, decides on behalf of the Jews. However, this time round, they are outvoted. Reuchlin himself is investigated, and Reuchlin himself is condemned, but the Archbishop of Gemingen once again, cancels the verdict and orders it back to committee. Parliamentary procedure at its best. The issue goes back to Rome itself and Pope Leo X. In November of 1513, Pope Leo orders Reuchlin to defend his defense of the Jewish books in front of an inquisitor, Jacob Hochstraten. So Reuchlin shows up. Hochstraten doesn't show. Reuchlin is acquitted. In June of 1514, Cardinal Grimani, I don't know of what area he was the cardinal, but Cardinal Grimani invites Hochstraten and either Reuchlin or a representative to come to a debate. And Hochstraten shows up this time. Reuchlin is winning the debate. This goes on over days. This isn't like a one-day thing or like, you know, four quarters and then overtime. Reuchlin is winning the debate, at which point the Dominicans pressure the Pope via their own power, because remember that, you know, when you create a police force, you end up sometimes creating your own downfall. You effectively arm this great spread out group of people, so that they end up pressuring the Pope via their own power to rule against Reuchlin. And the Pope rules against Reuchlin in 1520. And he issues a new decree, a bull, that all work will now be subject to censorship before publication. He doesn't have to destroy the existing books, but he's going to keep them from printing new ones. That's the idea. So yes?
Would a publisher have to submit a manuscript then?
You got it.
At that level? Okay.
Yes. You had local censors, and the publisher would have to work with the local censors. That's correct. And would have to get an official stamp saying approved in order to be able to go to press. Pope Paul IV, in 1559, publishes an index. This is the most famous index, probably. It's called the Index Expurgatorius, and it's a listing of books to be censored. Interestingly, the Church had generally avoided listing Hebrew books in the indexes, indices, if you will, lest that honor them and give them credibility. But now he expands that original list from Pope Gelasius, and actually most of the work on it is done by, you guessed it, a Jew who had converted, a man by the name of Domenico Hayerushalmi. That's how he signed his name, Domenico of Jerusalem. And that index actually lasts as an official list until Vatican II in the year 1966, at which point basically for practical considerations, they say, you know, let's just set this thing aside. It's actually not fully set aside. It's still a sin for a Catholic to read a book that is, quote, injurious to faith or morals. But there isn't an official list anymore, which is good because they'd probably run out of, you know, that paper or discs. But in any case, they also move into, in this same era, the 16th century period, they move into new methods of expurgation, which we're going to get to more about in the next section, but just a little bit here. The Council of Trent is responsible for this. They decide that it's time to start substituting words. So in other words, they order you that if you're going to write a book, don't use certain words, you're going to substitute other words instead. So for example, I mentioned this last week, the word Talmud, which was the classic name for Mishnah plus Gemara, the Jewish oral tradition, cannot be used. You could use the word Gemara, which is the Aramaic version of the same word. It means to learn, or work of learning. Shisha Siddarim, the six orders, because the Talmud was composed of, and is composed of, six separate sections. You could use that. So that Talmud became known colloquially as Gemara, or Shas, Shas being the acronym for Shisha Siddarim, before it was a political party. That became the term to use. It's very interesting. In a Beit Midrash, like, no one uses the term Talmud anymore. People use the term Gemara or Shas. The word Talmud is considered an academic word at this point. Even though originally that was the name and everybody used it. Another substitution, I enjoy this one. If you take a look on the reverse side of your pages, source number one, I enjoyed this. And we'll see more of these in a little bit. But sometimes the substitution rendered the text meaningless, and this is an example. Biblically, Esav, brother of Yaakov, right, Jacob's brother Esau, was identified with the nation of Edom. Edom will later become identified with Rome for reasons that are beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about today. But Rome, of course, is the church. So Edom was understood by the church to be a reference to the church itself, even when it made absolutely no sense. In scripture, that predated any such thing. You know, it didn't matter. They didn't like the word Edom. And they understood that they were being insulted if the word Edom appeared anywhere. So, with that in mind, here's a passage from the Talmud that ended up getting censored. An Edomi is the word. Edomi means an Edomite. Pushed Rabbi Eliezer. And a snake that had been there bit him. Bit the Edomi, the Edomite. Causing Rabbi Eliezer to cite the verse from Isaiah, and I will place Adam, a man, beneath you. Okay? In other words, Rabbi Eliezer should have been bitten by the snake. But he wasn't, because along came this Edomite, he pushed Rabbi Eliezer, and instead he got bitten. So he said, oh, I will place a man beneath you. Literally, this is a prophecy of Isaiah saying, when you behave properly, then I will place people beneath you. You will have people who will serve you. That's the literal take. He's taking it non-literally and saying, see that? I placed an Edomi beneath you. But the church didn't like that. And so they took out the word Edomi and made it Persian, which completely ruins the pun. The pun makes no, I will place a Persian. There was a Persian there, and I will place an Edomi. It doesn't make any, and I will place an Adam beneath, whatever. It doesn't work at all anymore. But that's what the church did, because that's what they did. They also annotated text. Do you have one of these?
Yes.
Okay. They also annotated texts. One of the terms that's often used Talmudically to describe a heretic is a min. Okay, min is in Hebrew, it's mem, yud, and nun. Literally, it means a variety or a type. But it's used to mean someone who is a heretic. So they would insist that if there was a text that used the word min, they would write in the margin, Jews who have forsaken God. Because they understood a heretic could often mean a Christian. They didn't like that. So therefore they had to say Jews who have forsaken God. It had to be written in the margin every time the word min was used. You end up with full margins that way. They got rid of anthropomorphism. If that was there, they would simply get rid of the text in ways that we'll talk about momentarily. Anything that they felt taught bad morals, they would get rid of. So that's what happens. That's what governs, really, this third phase of censorship. I want to move on to talk about the mechanics of censorship and what they did. The initial attempts were confiscate and destroy, but those didn't work for two major reasons. Number one, the Christians themselves would often save the books in order to resell them, right? Smart. And second, because Jews would simply hide the books. They would dig holes at the roots of trees. They would hide them in wells. You know, the book wouldn't survive the wells. Not that great, but, you know, that was the idea. And also because liberalization over time frowned on these harsher methods of just confiscating everything and destroying it. So they had to become a little more genteel. So they came up with this method we referred to before called expurgation, which ultimately Jews came to feel they could tolerate more, and therefore they didn't feel driven to extremes to try to avoid it. So that expurgation is done this way. Censors would come to a city and issue an order. All books must be submitted to the censor for examination and expurgation. The censor would give you a receipt. This was done very, very formally, so that you know you have a record of your books. The methods that the censors used changed depending on who the censors were, so that some did actually erase things, but that was tedious and difficult depending on the writing material that had actually been used. You're using early forms of paper, erasure doesn't go over so well, and you're just blotting it, basically. So,
excuse me, was the printing press in used?
This yes. Time? Yes, okay. This is already post-printing press.
So you'd have to every book. Okay.
Yeah, you're talking 16th century Italy at this point.
Okay.
So yeah. The erasure was pretty tedious. They would usually blot things. Most often they used a fine brush, just, you know, covering over the whole word so it'll be illegible. Sometimes they did a big brush and they did the bulk of a page. We have these. I mean, we're not just describing something hypothetical or theoretical. Museums have these expurgated books so you can see the way it was done. Sometimes you had careless censors and they were just not really taking the time they needed to take. They just wanted to get the books back to whoever owns them and go home. So they would expurgate an entire passage by just, you know, drawing a few lines like that through it, and that was that. Sometimes they would cut out a page or part of a page, or they would paste printed paper over it to make it unreadable. And the censors actually would sign a page at the end of the book. So we know, like, which censors did what based on their signatures.
And they all knew Hebrew.
So that brings me to my next point. Jews actually played a critical role, first of all, in compiling the index of passages to be expurgated, because the censors often could not read Hebrew. There was something called the College of Neophytes, and this was composed of Jews who had converted out of Judaism, and they would then help with this. And there was a book called Sefer HaZikuk, the Book of Purification, which listed specific passages and words as well as certain rules. It was written between 1594 and 1596. Again, a converted Jew. This is the one we mentioned before, this Domenico Hayerushalmi. Copies of it actually still exist, including one that's entirely in his handwriting. If you take a look on your sheet at the second side, source number 5, I gave you a link there to a blog post that actually brought a section of rules from the Sefer HaZikuk, so you can look there and see some of the rules that they employed.
Excuse me, why didn't they just go for the original press that printed the books? Why, they seem to be waiting until after all the copies have been printed and then doing them one by one.
Right. I think I have no illusion about the press itself. I think that probably where they could, they did go after the press.
Right.
But they still had the problem of all these books that are out and around.
Okay.
That they have to work with. The Jews, as I said, came to want expurgation, and they actually funded it themselves. Meaning someone had to pay the censors. And Jews ended up being the ones to pay the censors to censor their books because it was better than dealing with what the government would do otherwise. There's some great comic relief in the 19th century with the way that the Russians did this. The Russian church seems to have been a little bit, I don't know, in some cases they overdid it, in some cases they're just confused. So, for example, if you look on your sheet at the second side, I noted there in source number 2, item number 2, the word min, meaning heretic, and it also means species. So, there are works of law that have to deal with botany, and they talk about min, as in a species. But the church, the Russian church, really didn't like the word min. They felt, they could be talking about Christians. So they required that every time the word min was used, you substitute instead an acronym, akum. Akum is a Hebrew acronym, ayin kaf vav mem. It stands for Oved Kochavim Umazalot, which means a worshiper of the stars and the zodiac. And the idea was to distinguish Christians from other non-Jews. So every time it said min, they wanted to say idolater instead. That's basically the idea. So it'll be clear it's not the Christians. And the problem is that you had works of law that dealt with botany and mentioned min, and now it said akum instead. So in a work dealing with laws of legumes, which are rabbinically prohibited on Passover, you would see over and over again references to akum kitniot, idolatrous beans, the idolatrous legumes. Because they didn't know any better. Or my absolute favorite, also from the Russians. It's hard to say you have a favorite form of censorship, but nonetheless, in the 1830s, the Russians fought a war with the Turks, and they insisted that in censoring Jewish works, the word "goy," which they took to be an insulting reference to themselves, had to have instead the word Yishmael used, Yishmael meaning Arab, even though technically the Turks are not Arabs, nonetheless. They said you had to substitute the word Yishmael. Now, what they didn't realize is that the word Goy is not, by nature and by definition, an insult. The word Goy means nation, and in fact is often used biblically to refer to Jews. There are references to how great is this Goy, this nation that has a God who's close to it, and how wise is this nation, again the word Goy being used because it has a Torah. It isn't inherently negative. So take a look on your sheet at a prayer called Tachanun. It's a prayer in which Jews turn to God and apologize for sin and ask for mercy. So it's source number 3, and this is what you ended up with, because they substituted Yishmael, right, or as I rendered it on there, Turk, to make it more clear, for the word Goy. The original Hebrew is Shomer Goy Kadosh, Shmor Sherit Am Kadosh, Val Yobad Goy Kadosh, which translates to Guardian of the Holy Nation, guard the remnant of the Holy Nation, let not the Holy Nation be destroyed. However, thanks to the Russian censors, it now said Guardian of the Holy Turk, right? Guard the remnant of the Holy Turk, and not let not the Holy Turk be destroyed. Which I don't think is what they meant to have happen. But that's what happens sometimes when you censor something without knowing what you're doing. The roles that Jews themselves played in this, aside from the funding, first of all, sometimes Jews got themselves in trouble. Best example may be the Maimonidean controversy over the works of Maimonides, where there were Jews who were unhappy with his works and considered his works heretical to Judaism. And some of them actually went to the Dominicans and said to them, look at these books, they're horrible, you should burn them. And the Dominicans start reading that and say, where did he get this stuff from? And they start looking at the Talmud as well. And some suggest that that's what led to Nicholas Donnan's work in the burning of the Talmud in Paris in the year 1240, is that it starts with Jews. That's one. Number two, we've noticed it all along, converted Jews were the biggest help to the church in this. Number three is the Jews' embrace of expurgation as the least bad option. And then number four was self-censorship. Jews would decide for themselves, we don't want to publish dangerous books because we are going to get into trouble. So so that the Jews of Milan in 1550 agreed to stop publishing certain works in order to avoid them being burned. The Jews of Milan as a community did this. When Sansino published his Talmud in the end of the 15th century, he omitted all passages that the church was in the habit of censoring. So that traditional copies of the Talmud, down to this day, the last 20 years they've started using manuscripts to restore them, but until 20 years ago, any time a Talmud was published, it was missing those passages that the church had been in the habit of censoring, because the Jews said, it's not worth it for us to publish these things. It's just going to cause the books either to be expurgated or to be burned outright. Sometimes they left spaces to note there was an omission. And then sometimes they went even further. They would go even beyond. They would be, so to speak, more religious than the church, in order to make sure they'd be safe. Classic. On June 21st, 1554, Jewish communities in Italy, I believe this was, in the Italian provinces, declared that if you wanted to publish a book, you had to go to a three-person court to get approval. You actually had to get court approval from a Jewish court before you would publish a book, because they were concerned about this. Not only that, you had to get a leader of the community, or if you were in a small outlying area, the nearest large community, to approve it. And that led to a new version of what's called the Haskama. Haskama literally means approval. Originally, these were designed to be protections of copyright. You printed a book. You wanted everybody to know they were not allowed to reprint it. The rights are yours. So you would get a letter from a prominent sage saying, this is so-and-so's work, you better not reprint it, like what we talked about last week. Now you have a new use for the letter. The letter says, I read this and I see that it's not dangerous, and therefore we can print this. And that became a new use of the Haskama. The Jews of Mantua tried to stop the publication of the Zohar in 1558 because they were afraid that it might be burned. In Poland, in 1631, the rabbi sent out a letter ordering them to omit any reference to Jesus in new editions of the Talmud, but to leave a space with an O. And the rabbis would, quote, know how to teach the youths in each case. We'll know what to say. So you have this, to sum up where we've gone before the last component of it, you have the church employing censorship very early on as a general approach to heresy, ceasing really through the Dark Ages, and then beginning again with the revival of learning, with their approach of debating Jews, with the creation of the Dominicans and the Franciscans, as well as with the start of the successful Inquisition. You find them start again with this censorship, and particularly against Jews and against the Talmud most of all, because of anthropomorphism of God, because of statements they took as anti-Christian, because of statements that they believed to be warping biblical text. The first period of this is the 13th century. We talked about the burning of the Talmud in France in 1240. We talked about James of Aragon in the 1260s and Ahmadi's successful debate. In the second period, you have a lull where it's really unpopular to do this to Jews. And then the third period, when the church takes charge of printing presses, starts things all over again. And we looked at the specific case of Pfefferkorn and Johann Reuchlin, as well as Pope Paul IV's creation of the Index, and the Council of Trent moved towards expurgation. We talked about the mechanics of it, how the censors worked going from town to town to town, and the methods of erasure or blotting things or striking things out or pasting paper onto things. The Sefer HaZikuk that was written by this Domenico Hayushalmi, in which he listed specific passages in words, and then, of course, how censorship sometimes failed because it was just not done well. And we talked about the roles that Jews played in instigating this sometimes through our own squabbles, through helping them when Jews converted out, through opting for expurgation because it was the least bad option, and through self-censorship in order to avoid having the church do this to us. Finally, but perhaps most important, the lasting impact of this on Judaism. In a few different ways, Judaism and Jewish practice has been changed by censorship. One is very early on. In the year 553, Justinian forbade Jews from using anything other than a Greek or Latin translation of the Bible. Now, Jews in that period most often would use an Aramaic translation. Some of you may be familiar with Onkelos. Onkelos was the author of, or is credited with being the author of, the best and best known Aramaic commentary to the Torah, but there were actually quite a few. Because Jews who came to Israel out of Babylon at the time of the building of the Second Temple were best versed not in Hebrew, but in Aramaic. And so they began to use Aramaic to translate the Torah. During the Torah reading in the synagogue on Saturday, the reader would read a line, and then the translator would translate in Aramaic. And the reader would read a line, and the translator would translate. You think services take a long time now. You ain't seen nothing.
And that's how Onkelos got into the Stone Edition, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Onkelos is there because classically that was the way it was done. And there's actually a practice of studying the weekly Torah portion each week, twice in Hebrew, and once with the Aramaic commentary. And that's what Onkelos is generally used for. I mean, those who don't know Aramaic tend to use a commentary like Rashi, where they read in English. But that's why they keep putting it into the Chumash, even though most people can't read Aramaic at this point. And you can read it, but don't know what they're reading, which is too bad, because there's a lot there. Any case, Justinian forbade Jews from using this Aramaic in the year 553.
Could they read the Bible in Hebrew?
I think he would allow it. I think it's only that he forbids the translations other than the Greek and Latin. So I believe that that's what actually ended the use of the Aramaic commentary in Ashkenazic communities during the Torah reading. Because we know by the time you hit the 12th century, it's gone in Ashkenazic communities. I believe that's why. It survives in Sephardic lands because they're not under the church. So it survives there. Yemenite Jews do it to this day in some communities. They call it Tarjum. But I believe that the censor is what got rid of the use of the Aramaic in the Ashkenazi communities, the Jews living under the church. The Siddur, in general, the prayer book, was affected by this. Perhaps the most famous attack on the Siddur was the attack on Kol Nidre. The prayer of Kol Nidre is not really a prayer at all. Right? If you ever look at the translation, you can see it's not a prayer. We say it very solemnly. But it's not a prayer. What it actually is a declaration of nullification of communal vows. The core idea probably being, although there's some dispute, there are two standard kind of approaches to it. One approach is that as you enter Yom Kippur and as you declare we're all going to pray together, we'll even pray with those who have sinned, we also want the community to release people from bans, if anyone's been excommunicated over the course of the years, that they can come pray as well. So that's one possible explanation. The other explanation is simply that Judaism takes vows very seriously. Talmudically, we talk about it, you know, as a life and death matter, not to take oaths unless you're prepared to keep them. And so we wanted to declare publicly the nullification of vows. Well, the church took that as a ritual meant to permit Jews to defraud non-Jews. And what you're actually saying is, we will not be bound by any oaths that we make with people who aren't Jewish. It's entirely unfounded in the text. The text makes no reference to non-Jews. But that's what they said. And it actually caused some to argue that Kol Nidre should be dropped. The Reform movement actually did drop it for that reason, because of that charge. The other part of the Siddur that really came under attack was the Aleinu prayer. Aleinu is basically a national anthem of Judaism. It talks about how the Jew is literally obligated to, that's how it begins, to praise God, to recognize the wonders of what God has done for us by giving us the Torah, and so on. And it includes in it traditionally a line, which you can see in source number 4. For they, a reference to the nations of the world, bow to worthlessness and emptiness, and pray to a God who does not save. Make no mistake about it, it's chauvinist, absolutely. But that's the judgmental belief of the nations are praying to emptiness. Well, the church looked at this, and take a look at this. The word I put in Hebrew for emptiness, the word for emptiness is varik in Hebrew. There's a system called gematria, which assigns a numerical value to each letter of the Hebrew alphabet. The gematria, the numerical value of the word varik, is equal to the numerical value of the word yeshu. So they said, this must be a veiled reference to Jesus. He is emptiness, and it's an anti-Christian line. I kid you not. And Jews got in real trouble because of that, even though traditional Jewish belief is that this prayer goes back to the time of Joshua, long before there ever was anything such, you know, any notion of Christianity.
Excuse me, it's still in parentheses in the article, huh?
So some prior books took it out. Others left in the opening two words of the line, Shehem Mishtachavim in Hebrew, for they bow, and omitted the rest. I don't know if any were able to keep it in entirely in Europe. Today, some have put it back in entirely. Some have put it in parentheses, because they don't want to say you have to say it, because now for centuries Jews have not been saying it, but on the other hand, it's authentic. It's part of the original text. So that's why the art scroll has it in parentheses.
I never knew that until now, exactly.
Yeah. Now you know. So that's another effect.
Because I thought it was the pray to a God who does not save that the Christians objected to.
Right, so their problem was that they felt it was targeted to them. They have no problem with saying this about anybody but them. Yeah. The problem is personal. Another of the impacts is the way that courts became the authorities over publication, as we mentioned before. Another is the use of disclaimers. In the 18th century, authors in Italy, England, Amsterdam, and Germany started to use disclaimers in their works, saying that whatever we say in our books, whenever we talk about idolaters, we do not mean Christians. This does not refer to Christians. And they would write things like, it is not my intention to speak thus concerning the anointed ones who are called in the foreign tongue Christians. They are not idolaters. Now, you actually had disclaimers like that going back well before that, which said, you should know, we distinguish between nations of the world who have laws and courts and all that, and those who are barbaric. So you already had that as a disclaimer earlier on, for reasons of both substance and aesthetics, so to speak. This was just an aesthetic issue. This was, we need to make sure they understand we don't mean them. But the major impact was the loss of knowledge and the loss of authorities. One of the prayers that's recited on Tisha B'Av, this classic ninth of Av, day of mourning, is actually a eulogy, effectively, upon the destruction of the Talmud, the burning of the Talmud in Paris in 1240. That was what it was written to commemorate. And one of the lines in it says, "Miyachlina zirut miyachlina darim," which means, "Who?" It's a question. Who can now clarify vows of Nazirism, a vow of someone who wants to become a Nazir, a person who swears off wine and says he won't cut his hair, and who can now evaluate vows? That's the line. I did put it on the sheet. Who will clarify Nazirut and who will evaluate? I remember translating this and I couldn't see it on the second side. Who will clarify Nazirut and who will evaluate vows? And what that line is not a statement about the loss of sages. What it's actually about, or Soloveitchik said this, and I think it fits, is that the Talmud is traditionally published with Rashi's commentary, and it makes everything much more clear when you want to learn it. However, two volumes, there are actually more than two, but two in particular, lack Rashi's commentary in entirety. Not just on part of it, but in entirety. One is the tractate, the volume called Nazir, and the other one is Nedarim, the one about vows. And so what this line is actually saying is, we've lost Rashi's commentary to these volumes, and now we have a much harder time understanding them, because we're lacking Rashi. Who will clarify Nazirut, who will evaluate vows, is a play on words that are classically used regarding Nazirut and vows, but it's saying, we've lost now our means of understanding it, because Rashi's manuscripts have all been destroyed. It's not that Rashi never learns those volumes, it's that we don't have the manuscripts anymore to work with. And that was a major devastating impact of the censorship, particularly pre-printing press, but even afterwards, that the devastating effect that it actually had. On a lighter note, for our next class in 2 weeks, we'll be talking